Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
Hello, everyone. I have the pleasure today of introducing our speaker, Carrie Brown. Carrie is a partner at Baker Botts in Houston, Texas. She serves as trusted advisor to some of the nation's most prominent individuals on complex federal estate, gift and income tax litigation and controversy matters, including disputes and litigation with the Department of Justice and the Internal Revenue Service. Carrie counsels high net worth individuals and families in the U.S. Tax Court, U.S. District Courts, and U.S. Courts of Appeals. She also represents taxpayers in federal tax audits and administrative appeals and represents fiduciaries and beneficiaries of trusts and estates in state courts with respect to administration and fiduciary duty issues. Carrie, I'm really looking forward to this presentation. It was wonderful when it was done at Heckling. And with that, I'll turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you so much, Joshua. I will also say, because of the nature of my screen share, I can't see any of the Zoom controls, so if there are any questions that come through, everyone who's listening, you're at the mercy of Joshua on whether he is going to raise that question with me. And if there are questions that we don't have time to or don't see in time to answer today, please feel free just to reach out to me. I'm happy to discuss those further with you. So onward with the presentation. I have my watch on my hand because I don't have any clocks on my screen at the moment. My job is basically 80% dealing with the IRS and or the Department of Justice, as the case may be. The other 20% is fiduciary litigation related matters, typically in Texas state courts, because that's the only court in which I'm licensed. And so today, this discussion is going to be what's going on in the world of the IRS, specifically with respect to estate tax and gift tax, and where what are they looking at? Where are they going? This slide is basically an overview of where we're going to go today. Anticipate the dispute should be in the back of your head throughout this entire presentation. The first thing you want to do, you know, and the first thing we'll talk about on the next slide, prepare for audit at the planning stage. If you don't handle tax court litigation, if you don't handle estate tax audits, this is probably one of the most important things that I would like you to take from this is, when you are handling the planning for your client, get ready for audit at that time because it will make it much easier for everyone down the line. The IRS is staffing up. I just looked at some numbers. The Inflation Reduction Act of 2022 allocated an additional $80 billion to the Internal Revenue Service. Of that amount, $46 billion is earmarked for enforcements, and they are focusing on wealthy corporations, partnerships, and individuals. Just last week, they released a strategic report, they being the IRS. They said in 2025, 2026, their goal is to increase audits on taxpayers with income of more than $10 million from roughly a 10% audit rate to approximately a 16.5% audit rate in 2026. So they are staffing up. We are seeing some of that already because they are training a lot of new examining agents. Sometimes it may feel like the examining agents are training themselves on your cases. I cannot disabuse you of that notion because it is true, unfortunately. So some common IRS challenges. We'll get through as many of these as we have time to in the remaining 52 minutes or so. I will also say, please ask questions as you go. I like to have the back and forth. And so please feel free to submit those, and we will answer as many as we can. On your screen, I'm just not going to read them all. These are the topics that we will get to. So first of all, prepare for audit at the planning stage. Anticipate your potential audience. Your potential audience is an IRS, estate tax, or gift tax examiner. It could be someone who's been on the job for 3 months, 3 years, or 30 years, and you don't know who it's going to be. Our experience has been that in general, the more experienced an examiner you have, the more streamlined and tailored the request will be. The more junior an examiner you have, the more broad an information gathering the requests will be, because they don't know what they don't know at this point. The IRS does issue broad requests. Even this example here is not even as broad as what we're seeing in the last 6 to 12 months. But a request you should anticipate seeing if you have a client who ends up in an audit with the IRS is all documents related to the creation of the entity from any attorney, accountant, or firm involved in recommending the creation of the entity. It's in here because it's a literal copy and paste of actual requests from the IRS, to which you might say, hey, we have privilege. You can't have our communications with the clients or with the attorney or with the accountants. We have covel arrangements. You just can't have them. Thank you. Very good point. Takes me to my next one. Understand and preserve those privileges, right? There's attorney-client privilege, which everyone has a really good understanding of, typically. Work product privilege tends to be one step down in level of understanding. One of the takeaways for everyone on work product privilege from this call is don't be too quick to decide, I'm going to claim this as work product and therefore the IRS can't have it. Because you first have to reasonably anticipate litigation to claim work product protection. And if you reasonably anticipate litigation, go for it. It's work product from that point on. However, if you reasonably anticipate litigation, the flip side of that is you now have a duty to preserve, which means if you haven't been following a document retention policy and you suddenly decide, oh, we don't need all these documents, we can just get rid of them, you can't. You've triggered a duty to preserve. So it's very important. Don't be over aggressive in deciding something is work product. Attorney client typically will get you there with the protections that you want. And then finally, the tax practitioner privilege. This is a privilege under Section 7525. And it essentially protects the return preparers and the other people like accountants who are assisting and basically acting as a quasi-lawyer. They are fulfilling the same roles a lawyer might fill in, for example, gathering data to complete a tax return or provide general tax advice. That's the tax practitioner's privilege in a very small nutshell, like a peanut compared to like those big, whatever giant ones are you get in the mixed nuts. Anyway. Your files can be subpoenaed, even the emails. What we are seeing a lot of on some of the larger dollar cases is the IRS arguing that, let me real example. If the IRS argues penalties in a case, you get a notice of deficiency with penalties asserted. If the taxpayer wants to argue the reasonable cause exception, reasonably relied on my attorneys and the appraisers. Well, guess what? The tax court has said, if you're claiming you reasonably relied on your lawyers, you must waive privilege and produce the documents that show you reasonably relied, or else we're just going to deny it because you have not met your burden of proof. So even though you may plan the perfect transaction with minimal audit risk, if the IRS comes in and they decide, for example, you have a valuation understatement or you have a 2036 problem or you have any number of issues that they want to argue, if they also include a penalty assertion, you cannot claim reasonable reliance on the attorneys and the appraisers unless you produce the documents that support that reasonable reliance. Now, another case where we're seeing an IRS argument, active case right now, IRS has said that because we, the IRS, have asserted the economic substance doctrine, you are required to waive privilege to prove that the economic substance doctrine doesn't apply. And if you're looking around quizzically wondering what is up with that, I can tell you that's not a thing. We still nevertheless have to argue it. And hopefully we will get, if it makes it to the tax court having to hear this, we get the tax court to agree with us. Just because the IRS says it doesn't mean we have to waive privilege, unless we're back to the penalties issue and you have to support the reasonable reliance defense. We also are seeing, I mentioned much broader, broader requests. This is important. We're getting requests from the IRS for, give me the entire file. And so think right now of your most prolific emailing client and what you keep in the file and what they might forward on, any privileged communication you send them, they might be forwarding on to people. And think about any internal communications that you might have saved to your file for this client. And think about how those would look if you had to produce them to the IRS because they subpoena or they request your entire file and you have to waive privilege for the reasons that we talked about. If that is a little bit worrisome, my recommendation is consider your document retention policy, consider what you do and don't need to retain in the client's file, and have the client do the same thing. Hey, client, we finished this transaction a few years ago. Probably a good idea. If you have any old copies, old drafts, old whatever, you don't need to keep those. Of course, keep all your final documents, keep the final returns. We tell our clients, keep any advice you receive from a lawyer because you may need it to avoid penalties in the future. But I will tell you, not only does this create potential problems with what might be in the file that you don't know about, it also makes the challenge of complying with the IRS's requests a lot more expensive because now we have to first go through and provide everything that's not privileged. And then the IRS says, oh, penalties. Now we have to review everything else and potentially waive privilege. And anything in the file has to be reviewed again and produced. And all of that costs money. And it can be very, very costly to pursue a case before the tax court or even, frankly, just in front of the examining judge. All right. You as the planning lawyer, I'm on, let's see, third bullet from the bottom. You might have to testify about why the entity was created. So keep that in mind. Again, if there is a privilege waiver, you can be called to the stand. You may have to testify because there may not be anyone else around who understands the transaction and can testify about it. You want to help your client. The best evidence of, for example, non-tax reasons for taking certain action, such as creating a family limited partnership, is going to come from contemporaneous correspondence. Any transaction that you engage in with your clients that might end up down the road subject to IRS scrutiny, you may have to produce, again, all the communications. And one of the things the IRS is going to look for is, what did you tell the client? Did you only focus on, you're going to save so much money by doing this because you're going to save all this money in taxes? Or did you also focus on, hey, creating this partnership will help you get all the assets under one umbrella. And so you'll pass down pieces of the umbrella instead of pieces of individual assets. Hey, we're going to engage in this transaction, not solely because, hey, there's favorable valuation discounts here, but also because you need to plan for liquidity or you need to diversify. Those non-tax reasons need to be in the file and they need to be documented so that if 10 years down the road, I'm handling a case for this client or your favorite tax litigator is handling a case for this client, they can point to that evidence. This goes back to help the litigators prepare for audit at the planning stage. Make sure you have really good documentation in the file for the reasons why certain planning is being engaged in. I might also recommend, if you're comfortable with it and if your client is comfortable with it, having your client communicate with family members, it's not going to be privileged, but that's the point. Having your client communicate with the family members what they are doing and why they are doing it. This works best when you have the families that all get along, but having seen your family member put in an email or a letter to their children and or grandchildren, I am doing this because I want us to all work cooperatively and I want the younger generation to be educated about our assets and I want to be able to hand out pieces of the umbrella, not pieces of the asset. That's great because it's not privileged and we don't have to waive privilege to produce it and it helps make the case. It's kind of leading to this very last bullet point in here. It is absolutely A-okay to discuss the tax attributes of a certain transaction. If you say, no, we never thought about taxes, you will not be found credible. There's a tax court case out of Georgia, and I can't remember the name of it now, but basically the taxpayer got on the stand and said, no, we never thought about taxes. And the court said, I don't buy it. Of course, you're thinking about and talking about and planning around taxes, plus all these other reasons. So keep that in mind. All right. Stop talking about that for a minute. Valuation. I like this chart. It's a little bit hard to read, but I recommend you save it. This chart comes in handy when you're dealing with the examining agent for the IRS, and they say, there's no way that this partnership that only has marketable securities in it should get more than a 7% discount. And that's what our engineer says. That's what we're sticking with. You can say, huh, that's funny, because look at the third and fourth cases from the bottom. In Straightoff and in Grieve, those were both marketable security entities. And in one of them, the tax court held that there was an 18% discount for lack of marketability. And in the other one, the tax court said there's a 35% discount for lack of marketability. Go up a couple more to Richmond in 2014. Tax court gave a combined 46.5% discount. So I beg to differ, but you are wrong, IRS, and you are wrong, examining agent. This is a really nice kind of shorthand cheat sheet for favorable valuation discount results in the tax court and in federal district court. You will see generally the valuation discounts tend to be a bit higher in district court than they are in tax court, but there are more tax court cases listed on here than there are federal district court. Okay, let's switch gears. Now we're going to talk about formula transfers. Formula transfers, in brief, for those not very familiar with them, effectively allow the transferor, your client, the senior family member, to define, to fix the dollar value of a transfer. It gives them certainty because I'm fixing it at, I'm giving $1 million worth of value, or whatever that is. Very useful in, again, giving them some certainty. There are generally four types of formula clauses understood. The first one on here is the one that is currently the most popular for very good reasons. Just because it's the most popular doesn't mean it's the right fit in every situation, but it is a defined value clause. It's based on values. These quotes are important. As finally determined for estate tax purposes or as finally determined for gift tax purposes. That's what we saw in Christensen, Petter, and Wandry. The IRS continues to non-acquiesce in these kinds of defined value clauses. They continue to fight them. If you have an audit, your examining agent is likely to say, I'm not going to respect your formula clause. They are likely going to not respect the formula clause because they have been instructed not to respect the formula clause. And you may not be able to resolve this issue with the formula clause until you end up at IRS appeals, where the appeals officer has the authority to respect the formula clause if the circumstances warrant. Other three on here, defined value clauses. That's what we saw in McCord and Hendricks, which were also successful cases. There are price adjustment clauses in King. And then finally, there are reversion clauses. Those typically do not work. But I will say Proctor is from, I think Eisenhower was president when Proctor came out. So I think maybe no one has tested reversion clauses enough. Maybe the result would be different if 80 years in the future, i.e. now, someone tried this case again. So the language in your formula clauses definitely matters. Wandry at the top. Probably if those of you are doing planning with formula clauses, most of you, I assume, are probably using Wandry now because it's basically been adopted by most practitioners. In Wandry, what you say is, I transfer to my beloved daughter that number of shares of my company with the fair market value as finally determined for federal gift tax purposes equal to whatever that dollar amount is. What this means is you're limiting your exposure. If it's $1 million, that's it. It's $1 million. The IRS can come in. They can challenge the value. Okay, but if they successfully challenge the value and your Wandry clause is respected, all it does is change the number of shares that my darling daughter receives. It doesn't change the transfer that I made as far as value. Maybe I do have more shares that I still have that maybe I can transfer later, but doesn't change your dollar amount. In the interest of time, I will skip over, but again, these are in your materials, Petter and King. Do you want to briefly address Nelson? Because this was a case that went to the Fifth Circuit. And this was a taxpayer loss, but I'm going to tell you why. In this case, dear Mrs. Nelson wanted to make a gift and assign to a particular trust her interest in a limited partner interest, with a fair market value. You see it right there. I'm fixing the fair market value, $2,096,000 as of this particular date. But here's the important language. As determined by a qualified appraiser within 90 days of the effective date of this assignment. That language that's highlighted in red is why her clause, well, her clause was respected, but her value did change because the court found that the appraiser was wrong. Mrs. Nelson at trial said, I know this is what the language says, but I didn't mean it this way. I meant to say as finally determined for federal gift tax purposes. But the court said, hey guys, we're going to cite McCord because McCord was the first winning defined value clause for the taxpayers. And McCord said, the court in McCord said, we read the documents as they are. If this is what it says, then this is it. That's it. We are reading your document exactly as you wrote it, and we're not going to ascribe some other meaning to it. So unfortunately for Mrs. Nelson, she did end up with a valuation change because she did not have the formula clause similar to Wandry, similar to McCord, using that as filing determined for federal transfer tax purposes, which is what I think would have saved her case. Wasn't a big dollar amount at the end of the day. It still wasn't favorable to her. Okay, so talk about a Petter style formula clause. Let me just go back really quickly. Petter is a formula clause based on values as finally determined for estate and gift tax purposes. So, okay, who are my potential donees? Potentially a public charity or a donor advised fund. That's who it was in Petter. The reason why you might want to use a charity, not only is it because your client is particularly charitable and philanthropic, but one of the arguments the IRS makes, if there's no unrelated person involved, is none of your kids were ever going to challenge the value. This is just a play to save tax. Well, I would beg to differ. Wandry says we're totally fine if we do that. But, okay, for grins, we use a public charity. What are you going to say, IRS? They're going to say, well, you're just trying to have a disincentive to audit. That's all. We're going to say, well, look, our public charity has an independent fiduciary obligation. So they have an obligation to make sure our numbers are right. Our public charity is subject to the private inurement and excess benefit rules. And if the charity isn't going to enforce its rights, then the state's attorney general can come after the charity for not enforcing their rights. So the charity is absolutely incentivized. Make sure that they are getting the appropriate amount of the gift from your clients. We saw this in McCord, Hendricks, and Petter. Having a private foundation as the beneficiary of the excess amount is a little bit more difficult because private foundations have a lot more restrictions on them. And probably almost all of you have a lot more knowledge about private foundations than I do. What I know is there are issues, self-dealing issues, excess business holding issues, and other rules that make it fairly difficult for a private foundation to be the beneficiary of these of any potential excess benefit. And when I say excess benefit, what I mean is kind of the overflow, right? I give to my daughter $1 million worth of the shares. Everything else goes to the charity. That's the excess, the anything else. Could potentially have a lifetime Q-tip, be the recipient of the excess amount, maybe even a grant, maybe nobody. That's what happened in Wandry. Then it's dispensed with the third party altogether, and the court accepted it. We do have a non-acquiescence. We know the IRS is looking for the right case to challenge Wandry to try to get facts that are better for them. One question is whether a consideration adjustment would pass muster. I think it would. King, it worked in King, as long as it's not a reversion, should be fine as well. Okay, let us move on. Termination of Q-tips.
Before we do move on, Carrie, is there a particular version of the defined value clauses that you're most comfortable or feel most confident defending?
Any of them in the Fifth Circuit, because McCord and Hendricks came out of the Fifth Circuit. I hate to say this, but it's almost location-based. If you're in the Fifth, Eighth, Ninth or Tenth Circuit. I feel good about all of them because we have good appellate case law for all of them. In general, I will say I'm not a planning lawyer. So the question, what do I feel most confident defending? If you want most confident defending, I like the ones where they're in a charity, getting the excess amount. But, and the reason I like that is for all the reasons why it worked in McCord, Hendricks, and Petter. But Wandry is just fine. Wandry is a bit of a headache because you are going to have the examining agent who is unwilling, in most cases, to allow the Wandry clause to be respected, and you're going to have to go to appeals to have it be respected. So Wandry is good for business, but I would rather you guys not have to hire someone like me at all if you have, you know, the public charity where you can rely on three separate cases in which the tax court, well, in McCord, they did, but in which at least the Court of Appeals has said this is totally fine. Wandry clauses are becoming much, much, much more common. We also see them a lot in grant payments. So when annuity payment needs to be made back, often, I think almost maybe universally, people are using Wandry clauses. You know, that number of units equal to the amount of the payment as finally determined.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep. I also just happen to like charity, so give a lot of money to charity. Okay. QTIP termination is an odd bird. I have learned a lot about QTIP termination and the IRS arguments on it in the last couple of years. And we currently have two motions for summary judgment for two separate taxpayers pending at the tax court dealing with QTIP termination and the IRS arguments here. So let me tell you in a nutshell, the IRS arguments are based on the first three bullet points listed on here. The first one, chief counsel advice from 2021. Chief counsel said terminating a QTIP trust, followed by distributing the QTIP to the surviving spouse, right? So if you terminate, basically goes to the remainder beneficiaries, and then, but they distribute it to the surviving spouse, right? Chief counsel says this is a deemed gift. It's a deemed gift from surviving spouse to the remainder beneficiaries, and then a gift from the remainder beneficiaries back up to the surviving spouse. So that is want one, but two, count on two, taxable transfers, gift from surviving spouse to kids and gift from kids back to surviving spouse. Okay. All right. We have Treasury Regulation 25.2519-1A. I wish they would make things more citable, but they do not. If a donee spouse disposes of all or part of a qualifying income interest from life, any property in which they got the marital deduction, the donee spouse is treated as transferring all of the interest in property other than the qualifying income interest. Okay. And then we have Revenue Ruling 98-8, which says the surviving spouse's purchase of the remainder interest was a gift from the surviving spouse to the remainder beneficiaries. And then we have Treasury Regulation 25.2519-1E. Simply exercising your power to appoint your QTIP to the donee spouse is not a disposition under 2519. The IRS arguments on this are effectively, in both of the cases, the fact scenario is surviving spouse went to court to have the court approve a judicial termination of the marital trust, and all the family members agreed that surviving spouse would simply be distributed all of the assets of the marital trust and then would be free to dispose, frankly, as he or she saw fit. The IRS has said, no can do. That was a disposition, a taxable disposition. So again, you're taxed, surviving spouse, as though you made a gift to your remainder beneficiaries and your remainder beneficiaries made a gift to you. And also there's going to be a third level of tax applied by virtue of either when you die holding the assets or when you transfer the assets during life. So essentially three times we have a taxation event instead of simply one. Everyone agrees in this case, there's absolutely a tax when the surviving spouse dies on whatever is left, whatever they didn't consume during life or transfer via an inter vivos transfer. Yes, there is a tax there. The dispute is, are there these intervening two taxes? Our argument is no. It's simply not a disposition under 2519. The IRS is taking a much broader view and saying it absolutely is. So again, two cases, two motions for summary judgment pending. We had a hearing with one of the judges in, I believe it was March. And so, I mean, however long it takes a judge to make a decision and write an opinion, we hopefully will have some guidance on our arguments. Maybe in the next 6 months or so, maybe 2024, we will get something from the court on Q-tip terminations. We do have a third case where this is pending. And the fact that we have three of these means there's a lot more going on around the country. We don't just happen to get all of these. Okay, adequate disclosure. This one I like. I like talking about adequate disclosure because we actually had a bit of an update thanks to the tax court in 2023 with the Schlapper case. So we all generally know what the adequate disclosure rules say. Effectively, if you report the GIRT tax return, it's not the GIRT tax return, it's the gift tax return. Transfer reported is adequately disclosed if the return or if something attached to the return describes the property, identifies the relationship, provides information about the trust, a description of how you determine the value, and you know, if you're taking a position contrary to regs or other rules, what that position is. Okay. And so what we often do, and as I understand, this is really a practitioner by practitioner decision. We typically recommend to the clients, even if you have simply a sale transaction in the year, go ahead and disclose that on your gift tax return to get your statute of limitations running on this. I'll talk more about that when I get to DOMI liability in a couple of slides. Just to close the loop on adequate disclosure, before the Schlapper decision came out, it was broadly understood, because of the position the IRS took, that you had to have not merely substantial compliance with the adequate disclosure regulations, but you had to have strict compliance. If you missed even a single sub-letter, you did not adequately disclose, and therefore you did not start the statute of limitations running. Tax court in Schlapper came out a year ago this month, said, look, adequate disclosure requires substantial compliance, not strict compliance. That said, you must substantially comply with each requirement, not substantially comply with the regulations overall. So you have to be able to say, oh, look, I substantially complied with each one of these individual requirements. You can't just say, I did enough overall. So it's very helpful, but I would say don't see this as an invitation to take your foot off the pedal with respect to disclosing as much as you possibly feel comfortable disclosing, because I see Schlapper as basically a saving case, not one that says you can do less than you are doing. It is, if you get an argument that you didn't adequately disclose, you Schlapper and argue that you did. You substantially complied. All right, DONI liability. It's only one slide ahead, not a couple of slides. Okay, DONI liability is real. It can exist for a donor's gift tax under 6901 or 6324B if the donor doesn't pay. This is important in considering whether to file a gift tax return to adequately disclose a sale transaction, again, to start the statute of limitations running. Because if you have a 55-year-old client who does purely a sale transaction this year, and it is reported on the gift tax return, then great, you've got the statute run in 3 years for that client. If, however, it's not disclosed on their 2024 gift tax return and they die at age 85, you're now in 2054, and the IRS says, hey, when did they transfer this? Oh, that was a gift because you didn't value it properly. You now have gift tax, and you have 30 years of interest on top of that. It's a huge number. And so not only might the donor, maybe now the deceased donor at age 85, maybe they don't have the ability in the estate to pay, but the IRS can look to the donee if there's not enough funds. So the donee's statute of limitation expires 1 year after the donor's statute of limitations expires. So, for example, you file on April 15th of 2025, the sale transaction this year, your client's statute will expire in 2028, and then the donee's statute will expire in 2029, and then you're done. That's it. They can't come back. The IRS could come back and say you didn't adequately disclose, and you would say, yes, I did, yes, I did, yes, I did. And even if I didn't strictly comply, you need to take a look at Schlapper. There is a question and there is a circuit split on whether the donee liability for gift tax is limited to the value of the gift received or is unlimited liability for interest. So you guys are in the First Circuit. I can't give you any real opinion on what the first Circuit might do here, but the Third, Fifth, and Eighth Circuits have all said gift tax liability is limited to the value of the gift received. You've got the 11th who said, nope, unlimited liability for the interest on this. It's the interest that ends up hurting when you have, you know, a 10 or 15 or 20 years down the road discovered gift that the IRS argues wasn't adequately disclosed. Okay, let's talk about promissory notes. Hannah, promissory notes are interesting because most of the time they're just fine. And the only time they're not is when the IRS decides that they are not. Most of us likely just use the safe harbor, use the AFR on our promissory notes for intra-family transactions, and that is okay. You will hear the IRS say that is not okay. It is okay. You will hear the IRS say it's a device, it's illusory, it's this, it's that. Okay, well, you may have to fight that case. Our argument all day is going to be it is okay. All right. If you have a promissory note, one argument you likely will have from the IRS is this wasn't a bona fide loan or this was actually a disguised gift. And in that case, the tax court's going to look at these eight factors that are on your screen. This is not a strict compliance. It's really more of a substantial compliance. And frankly, really more of a, what does the tax court think about what actually happened here? It is very much facts and circumstances. You could theoretically, and I think you could comply with six or seven of these, and maybe the tax court would still say it's not enough. You can comply with two or three, and the tax court might say it is enough. I think generally the more of these you can comply with, the better. Always, always, always a very good idea to have a note. Have a written note. Have it require interest. Have a repayment schedule. IRS likes to argue, oh, it was interest only for 10 years, 20 years, whatever, and then all principal. Doesn't matter. You still had a repayment schedule. But look at whether it was secured, whether there was any collateral. This is one where it's sort of a, if you have collateral, that's great. It goes a long way towards showing it's bona fide. If you don't, it doesn't mean you're sunk. Did you demand repayment? Well, in a lot of these cases, maybe it's interest only and you don't owe the principal for any number of years. And even if you have paid the interest, your clients paid the interest religiously, I guess the recipient, the obligor, the IRS likes to argue, well, you never even demanded repayment. The answer to that sometimes is because nothing was due. They still like to argue. All right. Do you have records that reflect the debt? Is it included? If your client has financial statements, is the promissory note included as an asset? Are they receiving income and reporting it every interest every year and reporting it as income? Is there actual repayment? This might be maybe the second, maybe third most important factor. If repayment was actually due during the time that's at issue, was there actual repayment? Because I think you're making the argument for the IRS much harder. They can't argue it was not bona fide, it was just illusory, if repayments actually happened. And then another issue is borrower solvency. This one is important because there was a case that came out, I believe in 2022, and I don't remember the name of it, but I think it was a fairly common last name. And the issue was at the time that mom kept making loans to her son, was it a bona fide loan or was it a gift? And the court said, well, we've got to look at whether he was solvent at the time these were made. And in the early years, son was solvent when she made these loans. So these all count. These are bona fide. They're not gifts. But in later years, after mom had already loaned him a couple million and he didn't repay and she kept loaning him more and more money, He wasn't solvent. There was no reasonable expectation of repayment. Those were gifts. So I guess probably top three for me, top four. There's so many exceptions that it kind of eats the rule. Whether there's a note, whether there's defined interest, whether there's actual repayment, and whether the borrower is solvent. Those, I think, are the ones that should be focused on. Okay, installment sales. A lot of you probably have clients who are selling assets to their children. Again, in exchange for promissory notes with installment payments. Lots of issues, and I don't mean issues in a bad way. I just mean lots of areas the IRS likes to examine here. They're going to look at the fair market value of the interest that is sold. Oh, you said you sold interest in your partnership to trust for your children. Well, I think you undervalued it. It actually was worth a lot more, and so they owe a lot more. You made a gift. Okay? That's one argument. Another argument is this Pierre issue, the application of the step transaction doctrine. If you make, for example, a gift and a sale on the same day, you can have issues there with valuation. Another problem again, I don't mean issue, I'll say, is what consideration did you receive? What was it actually worth? And then finally, the value of the note. Do you get to rely on 7872 as your safe harbor that the note has been valued properly, or is it just an interest rate safe harbor, meaning you're not making a gift on the interest? Okay. Let's flip over. Let's go to the next stage in life, the estate tax issues. We see a lot arguments regarding Section 2036 and Section 2038 with respect to the interest that was sold. Oh, you sold this interest 20 years ago to trust for the benefit of your kid, but you held on to those impermissible strings. So we're going to pull the entire value of that back into your estate and tax it as a phantom asset. Okay, then we get to fight 2036. There is, again, the Pierre issue, whether there was adequate and full consideration. Where this can be a problem is, again, if you make a gift and a sale on the same day or very close together, there's no adequate and full consideration for your gift. Just isn't. But the argument would be there was adequate and full consideration for the sale. But if the gift and sale pieces are smushed together for valuation purposes, then you are almost always going to fail the adequate and full consideration with respect to the smushed together amalgamation of your gift and sale. So that can be an issue, and it can cause 2036 issues. Another issue here is, again, payment of the note. What you end up with is, this is the where the tax court kind of, it's not really famous, but famously to me because it was such a great visual. It talked about the donut and the donut hole, and making sure that the IRS is getting the full amount of tax on everything. If the IRS is successful in their 2036 argument in pulling assets back into the estate, well, it's not fair, and the tax court acknowledges you can't just include it all without including some sort of offset for the payments that were received on any note. And so they came up with this fairly convoluted way you're supposed to figure that out under Section 2036 and Section 2043. So, issue. All right, grats. We talked about grats when we talked about the formula clauses. Grats are a common area of inquiry, area of interest by the IRS when you when your client has had a grat. The first thing that the IRS is going to look at is, did the terms of the grat comply with the regulations under Section 2702? If they didn't, it's a gift. That's bad outcome. Not only did the terms comply, but was the grat operated in accordance with its terms? Can you substantiate that the annuity payments were made on a timely basis? And then the Atkinson analysis effectively make sure it's not enough that the documents say what you're supposed to do. You have to actually do it, and you have to do it in a timely manner. All right. Another issue that the IRS has with grats is valuation at every stage along the way. At every place the IRS might be able to argue that there's a valuation issue, they're going to at least examine it. Whether they get to the point of making any arguments to you is another case. But they're going to look at what was the value of the assets when they were transferred, and do we agree that they were valued appropriately? they're also going to look at, oh, you had a power of substitution. Did you exercise the power of substitution? And did you transfer, let's say, cash or interest in a closely held entity? Oh, was that cash a sufficient value of substitution? They're going to say, oh, you didn't use cash to pay the annuity. You used hard to value assets. You used, as is often the case, interest in the entity you paid back. That's another opportunity for there to be a valuation disconnect. So for exercising a power of substitution and using hard to value assets to pay the annuity, good idea to use something like a laundry clause or the King provisions for those. Effectively, that means if your grant payment is $5 million and you're transferring interest in an entity, I'm transferring that number of partnership interest in my partnership equal to $5 million as finally determined for federal gift or estate tax purposes. And that's going to save that payment. I cannot say it's going to save that payment because the IRS still hasn't really acquiesced to laundry, but that's going to give you a lot of arguments for why there's not a gift there, because I've got a clause there that says you just revalued it. That's all there is to it. Okay. Beatty is a case that came out in 2021. It didn't come out. I apologize. It was settled. This is an issue where the IRS said, hey, if you've got publicly traded stock that we have to value, you have to consider the merger negotiations. And here you had a gross valuation error. After the taxpayer filed motions for summary judgment on these issues, the IRS conceded the issue. So keep in mind, you know, a lot of times if you think it's public, if it's publicly traded stock, you think you're clear because the IRS isn't going to really challenge that because it's a knowable value. But if there's a merger coming up, maybe not. Okay, 2036 is our most litigated issue. 9 minutes left. Yeah, we can do this. Brief overview of 2036. It says you include in the gross estate the value of all the property in which a decedent made a transfer under which the decedent retained the possession or enjoyment of, or the right to the income from the property, or the right to designate who's going to possess or enjoy the property. There is an exception, and this is an exception that if the taxpayer is going to win, they are going to satisfy this exception. It is called the bona fide sale exception. And it says, if you transferred assets in a bona fide sale for adequate and full consideration, then you get out of 2036. The bad thing about 2036, if you don't know, is all of the assets of the entity, even if you transfer it 20 years ago, might be brought back into the estate for valuation purposes, even though the estate doesn't actually get all of the interests back. You also could theoretically end up with a marital deduction mismatch or a charitable deduction mismatch, something else just to keep in mind. So bona fide sale, this is our favorite part of 2036 because it's the exception that saves the taxpayer. It's a two-part test. Requires first that there be adequate and full consideration. What that basically means is, were the interest proportionate to the value received? Was the value of the contributed property credited to the capital accounts? That one is usually fairly easy. That's kind of a check, check, check. You did it. The second part is where, if the taxpayer is going to have any issues, it will be here. And if the IRS is going to win, it will be here. You have to have a bona fide sale. This requires a significant and legitimate non-tax reason for creating the entity. And it is a case-by-case analysis. Have here six different reasons, non-tax reasons for creating the entity: centralized management, involving the next generation, creditor protection, preserving an investment philosophy, avoiding, again, the interest being passed piecemeal, and avoiding imprudent expenditures. This is one of the reasons why it's important during the planning stage, we talked about 50 minutes ago, to make sure that we have good contemporaneous documentation of the purposes. Why are we doing this? Consider each one of these, which of them apply and why. And can you get your client to send a communication to all the family members who are affected, say, here's what I'm doing and why, including some of these very key components? This will go a long way if you end up in a 2036 dispute eventually. just found where my clock is on my screen. Now I can stop looking at my watch. Section 2036A2 is a section that the IRS, unfortunately, has had some decent success in recently. For a while, the 2036A1 cases were kind of maybe half and half, and then they finally came in with A2, and that one kind of threw taxpayers for a curve for a few years. 2036A2 relates to the taxpayer retaining the power to designate the person who controls the income. And this affects taxpayers, your senior family members who decide they want to continue to hold on to the general partner interest. And so the IRS says, well, you had the power to control who got the income because you had the power to make distributions, you had the power to vote on dissolution of the partnership, withdrawal, et cetera. Okay. We do have a good case from the Supreme Court. Byram says, with respect to distribution powers, if the agreement gives the trustee, in this case, unlimited discretion, then that is a right under 2036A2. But if the power is circumscribed by cognizable limits on the exercise of discretion, then there's no such right. And so you don't lose 2036 just because there are distribution powers. The way to draft around this is actually on the next slide. So let me flip over to that one. So Powell versus Commissioner Court said that 2036A2 applied because the decedent as a GP could dissolve the partnership and her son was the general partner, her agent could control the timing and amount of distributions. So Powell was the bad 2036A2 case. So there are potential ways to avoid this holding. And it basically is, the best way is get your client to get rid of all their interests, but understanding your clients may not want to do that. Like if the first one is satisfy the bona fide sale, right? Have them get rid of all the interests and give back adequate and full consideration. Could also create two classes of interest. The non-client, the non-one you're worried about gets to vote on dissolution and amendment. And then your client doesn't get to vote on dissolution and amendment. You can have your senior family member dispose of the interest more than 3 years before death. Or you can terminate the entity more than 3 years before death. Neither of these are perfect. There are pros and cons of all of them. So don't take as this one of these will stay. You have to figure that out. Okay. Valuation understatement penalties. I talked at the front about penalties and the potential need that you have to give the IRS your entire file for your client if they assert penalties. There are substantial valuation understatements, which result in a 20% penalty. Gross valuation understatements, which result in a 40% penalty. The IRS got a little bit of a setback recently where the court said that they hadn't complied with the penalty requirements. They didn't get supervisory approval. So now for all of our clients, we are seeing requests from the IRS, confirm you agree we complied with the penalty requirements to assess the penalties. I'd rather not, right? So there is, again, a reasonable cause exception. It does require the taxpayer to act in good faith and with reasonable cause. You can rely on professional advice, as we mentioned. Whether it's reasonable to rely on an appraisal is a bit of a case-by-case basis. But if you have a qualified appraisal by a qualified appraiser, you're fine. Morissette versus Commissioner at the bottom. This is a 2021 case. This one you should know about. The client's privilege, asserted attorney-client privilege. And the tax court said you waived your reasonable cause based on legal advice. And then further, they unreasonably relied on the appraisal just because the valuation just wasn't good enough, effectively. Split dollar life insurance is the last thing we have in our slides. And it's, you know, with 2 minutes left. So that's perfect. The tax court has decided three split dollar life insurance cases dealing with the economic benefit regime. And those are Morissette, Levine, and Cahill. The IRS, there have been sort of mixed results here. The tax court has generally respected the structure of the transaction, but has changed the valuation result. Because, for example, maybe the value was very low because you assume these aren't going to pay out for many, many years. Tax court has said you have to consider when you reasonably expected these to be paid out. And it's not necessarily upon the death of the insured, but maybe it's when you surrender the policies. Okay. So good on the law for the taxpayers, good legal results, valuation results for the taxpayers, not as great. Okay. All right. That's economic benefit regime. There's another regime called the loan regime for split dollar life insurance. That is a new focus of the IRS. We tried a case in September and October of last year in Los Angeles. We just finalized the briefs on April 22nd, which is why I couldn't do this presentation before then. That's stupidity. And it is a loan regime case. The IRS declined our request to take the case to IRS appeals, which is only the second time they've done that in my career, the third time in my partner John Porter's career. Denied the request to go to appeals because they said, we need case law. There's no case law in loan regime split dollar. We want that case law. We're going to make you go to trial. So that case has gone to trial, went to trial last year, has now been fully briefed. We are now waiting for the tax court to issue its ruling. Given that it is an issue of first impression for the tax court, we think it is likely that we will end up with a tax court opinion on this instead of just a tax court memo. And again, it likely will be a couple of years before that comes out. So with that, I will tell you, I will stop sharing my screen. In addition to the slides that I think have been made available to all of you, there also are the written materials that are, you know, some 80 pages. If there's anything that we talked about that we didn't get in enough detail about or anything you want to read more about, take a look at those materials. They're pretty good. And then any other questions, we're technically out of time for me to answer them, but I'm happy for any of you to drop me an email or give me a call, and I'll do what I can to help answer those. Joshua?
Thank you very much, Carrie. This was great. Lots of useful information, and I don't see any questions because you did such a good job explaining everything. And so I think with that, we can wrap up the program.
All right.
Thank you so much again.
Thank you, everybody. I should have brought my unicorn. John runs Boston because he's the marathoner. He brought me back the unicorns, the mascots. I took them home to my kids because I'm a nice person. But I wish I'd had the unicorn to show you guys. Thanks again.
Good buddy. Thank you. And thank you for everyone for listening in.
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion. Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more. This special offer is only available through March 15th, 2024. Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.